Hi, welcome. My name is Christy Walters, and I am a district formative assessment coach for Corona Public Schools. I'm also one of the formative assessment leads for the FAME project for the Michigan Department of Education. So I'm going to go through this at a pace that is hopefully fairly quick. If you have questions, please feel free to stop me, but I know some of you want to get out before traffic is really bad, but I don't have to leave right away, so if you have questions at the end, I'll try to save some time for that as well, especially if you have questions about the FAME project or anything that you see in the slides. So I'm going to infuse a little bit of this idea along with some of my own experiences of working with teachers around data, teachers and sometimes the more challenging people are the administrators or the school board members, but I'll kind of share some of the experiences I've had with you as we go through. So first of all, who's in the room? Do we have any teachers in the room? Administrators? Oh, so I already offended two people. District level? Okay. University? School board? What do you do, sir?
ISD consultant.
ISD consultant. Anybody else an ISD consultant? Okay. So I love this idea of what is learned here stays here. So we're going to talk about the different types of data. We're going to talk about the different types of data that you might access in your school district and how it can actually be used. Because I oftentimes see people wanting to use data in a way that isn't appropriate to the way that data is intended to be used. A lot of times I see people thinking that MSTEP data should be driving everything that's going on in our classrooms, and that's absolutely not true. We don't get enough information at a fine grain from the MSTEP that we can really do anything with it at the classroom level. So we'll talk about that as well. All right, so some questions that we want to answer when we're thinking about the types of data that we're going to use is, what do I want to know? We always want to start there, because if you don't have a question, we can't tell whether or not the data is going to be able to answer the question. Sorry, I don't think I turned. Forgot I had to turn that on to record the session. So what do I want to know? Then what data will answer that question that I want to know? I worked with a teacher one time, and I was trying to talk with her about some data because we had just had a conversation. We were co-teaching together, and she had 5 sections of language arts, and I only co-taught 2 with her. So I said, I'll take the papers from our 2 classes and grade them for you, because you're still going to have 3 classes worth to grade. So let's talk about how we're going to score these. And her only answer was, I'll know it when I see it. I was like, well, I won't know what you saw when I see it. So we need to kind of be on the same playing field. We need to be talking about, what are we looking for? What is the success criteria here? And I said, what kind of data do we want to collect? And she said, there's no data we could collect. There's no questions I have. So I really needed to mediate her thinking more around, what is it that we want students to know and be able to do, and how are we going to know whether or not they can? So we have to talk about whose job is it to collect this data, and then how is it going to be shared in a way that teachers will be able to understand it. So we're going to look at these common 6 types of assessment data, and I hope to break it down in a fairly simple way for you that you would be able to share with the teachers. There weren't any teachers here, but that hopefully teachers in the classroom would be able to understand. So it's not going to be higher level talking about the research behind all of these, but basically what kinds of things will they answer for classroom teachers or school districts. So a question that universal benchmark screeners will answer is it likely, not definite, but is it likely that my students are where they should be? And how that looks is, it's a quick assessment of skills that are given to all students, usually about 3 times a year. You are required to have one of these for early literacy, as I'm sure all of you guys know, as part of the Read by Grade 3 law. So that could be your NWEA MAP, excuse me, your Beacon, your iReady, Early Literacy and Math Benchmark Assessment, DIBELS, any of those types of things that the students usually take in the fall, the winter, and the spring. In my district, we take the Early Literacy and Math Benchmark Assessment for K-2 because it's in the DRC Insight portal, so that students have an opportunity to get used to that portal. And also, it's really nice because it doesn't totally mirror the MSTEP, but it's written by Michigan educators along the Michigan state standards. And then we use the we use the Beacon for grades 3 through 7, just because it's also in the DRC Insight portal, and it's like a full-length MSTEP that they have an opportunity to practice taking. But there are lots of different options up there. Then the questions that this data can answer is the tier one curriculum and instruction being effective? And we know that it is when 80 to 85% of our students are at tier one. And if 80 to 85% of our students are not at tier one, then we have a tier one problem because we can't intervene our way out of a tier one problem. Unless you're gonna dedicate your classroom teachers to having 90 to 100 kids in their class so that all the rest of your teachers can become interventionists and work with small groups of teachers, then you really have to fix your tier one first. So a really good question that universal benchmark screeners will answer for us is our general classroom curriculum working? But it won't tell us how we can fix it if it's not. It won't tell us what tier two or tier three interventions our students need. It's just going to tell us whether or not we're on the right track and whether or not, in some cases, our individual students are on the right track. But if we want to know what is it that students need to be able to do that they're not able to do, that they're not scoring tier one on this, it's not going to answer that question for us. So it's important that we look at the individual student data just to know, are they likely on track? There are definitely false positives and false negatives with this data, in which case we want to give our students a diagnostic assessment if this isn't matching what it is that we're seeing in the classroom. And at the grade level, again, this is where I think it's most powerful probably, is at the grade level when we're looking across, are the majority of our students where we would expect them to be on these assessments? These are great conversations to include your classroom teachers, your special education teachers. If you're talking about behavior, then your social worker or your school counselor, and having your administrator be part of that team. So once you look at that universal screener data, then you're going to ask yourself, what further data do we need to answer these questions? For an individual student, we want to know what knowledge or skills is the student lacking, because again, we don't get that from this. It doesn't go down to a fine grain where we can see the questions that the student missed, and even if the student did miss an individual question, there might be a different reason behind it than just that the student doesn't have the skills or knowledge. And then at the grade level, are we seeing across the grade level that there is something missing? So here's an example of the universal screener report from the Early Literacy and Math Benchmark Assessment that the state puts out. So this is from one of the students in my district, and we can see that in the fall, the student was scoring 4 out of 6 in the literary text, and then 5 out of 6 in the winter, and then in the spring. But this is going to be more powerful to us at the end of the year when we look at it, because this test, just like MSTEP, is based on end-of-year benchmarks, so we don't expect our students to know those in the fall. We would expect, but in the spring, we're hoping that our students' raw score on this assessment is around 80%. And if 70 to 80% of our students are not at 80%, then we need to start having a conversation about there's something that's not right with our Tier 1 curriculum, but this test isn't going to tell us what that is. It's just going to be a red flag for us. It also serves as a red flag as the Read by Grade 3 law, that this student, if they weren't doing what we expected at this point in the year, would need a diagnostic assessment. This is just another piece of that report that comes out. So it does break it down into some things. So like if we look at that top one, understand key details, retell stories, including central messages, describe character, setting, and events. Well, we see that the student scored 4 out of 5 of those points and 3 out of 4 in the winter. There are way more than 4 questions we could write from that. We have no idea what those questions look like. We have no idea whether or not the student had any context for that story. There could have been 4 questions on key details and no questions on retelling. It doesn't tell us what that student needs. So you just want to keep that in mind. If you use AIMSWeb, then you might get a report that looks something like this that just tells us what percentage of our students are at tier 1, tier 2, or tier 3 to say, hey, do we have a problem in this area? Again, it just serves as a red flag, but it doesn't really answer the question of what is the problem. These are just more reports. There's another AIMSWeb report, so I'm just showing you some examples. So when we see that we have a problem with less than 80% of our students at Tier 1, then we can start looking at the next level of report, or the next level of data, and that is the diagnostic assessment data. And this answers the question of what specific skills or knowledge are students missing. But before I go on to that, does anyone have any questions about universal screener data? I know one frustration in my district is the amount of time that it takes. that our students, they come back from Christmas break if they're taking the early literacy and math benchmark because they set the window for that, and then we're spending a couple of hours in class time. I know that in the kindergarten building where I work, we take their technology time for a week so they don't get technology for a week because they're not testing in the classroom, so that we don't take away their math and literacy time. So I know that's one frustration. And I know another frustration that I have, and I think some of the teachers have, is when they get these reports, they really want to be able to do something with them and say to the student, here's what we're going to work on. And that's not what it's intended for. But they say, we spent all this time, but really it's just this big picture idea. And in my district, we give every student, K-3, a diagnostic screener anyway, regardless of how they do on the benchmark assessment. Sometimes there are barriers with the technology. This year I had the first instance that I really recognized it. I'm in the kindergarten testing every single day that they're in their testing, so it's me and the technology teacher, so I get to witness it. And this year we had students with glasses, a number of kindergartners with glasses that I had never recognized as being an issue before, but they couldn't wear the headphones in their glasses at the same time. They said that it hurt their ears too much. So then we had to figure out, how are we going to allow them to access listening to this because they can't read at the same time as wearing their glasses, and did we have alternate locations? So there are just a lot of frustrations that can come along with doing these tests and the technology with it. We use touch screens, and sometimes the kids have their fingers in their mouth and then they touch the screen and then they're crusty and they don't swipe anymore. So just a lot of things to keep in mind, that sometimes the scores aren't exactly telling for that student. So we want to think about, what are we noticing about that student in class? So then we move on to our diagnostic assessment data. And these are more detailed evaluations of the student's strengths and needs, and usually they're done one-on-one. So some examples of this that you might use in your building: MLPP, the DRA2, the informal decoding inventory. Some of your school psychologists might be using the Woodcock-Johnson. Sometimes a teacher-created pretest can serve as a diagnostic if they're going to go back and analyze the data, but that's not necessarily valid or reliable if the teacher has created it him or herself. So just kind of keep that in mind. So this type of data can answer the question, what are the individual students' strengths and needs? So this might look like doing letter sounds, and they're going to probably test all 26 letter sounds. Or it might look like they're reading a set of real CVC words and a set of CVC words. And then we might look at how they're reading their R-controlled real words and R-controlled nonsense words. So we're really looking at those very specific skills to see what students have and what they're using but confusing and what they don't have at all. So those are the questions that we're trying to answer here. Where is the student at right now, and where do we know that they need to go next? So without looking at group trends in this, we can't decide what we're going to do with our Tier 1 instruction, but if we do notice some group trends that none of our kindergartners can read CVC words, then we might be able to go back and say, what does our phonological awareness training look like with our blending and our segmenting? Or if we notice that we're giving the DRA to students in kindergarten, which is a practice that we stopped, we might recognize, well, we don't expect our kindergartners to be able to read this type of text by the end of kindergarten. So is it really something we're doing wrong, or is the test inappropriate? So we're able to answer those questions when we can look at group data. But we don't always know which strategies are going to work best with students. But we always want to be looking at individual students' data or the whole group's data. So I broke this one down into two separate things so that I can show you how that might look different. Classroom teachers need this. The student needs this. The student needs to know where they're at so that they can help set goals for what it is that they want to acquire as well. So some next steps might be to determine if additional student work samples are necessary, setting SMART goals, and then choosing research-based interventions and progress monitoring, especially if the students aren't where we would expect them to be on these measures. So some examples of this might be a student writing sample. A student writing sample will tell us so much about so many different things, whether or not students can encode, whether or not students can decode, whether or not they can blend and segment. There's just so much that can happen from a small writing piece like this. Then we have an individual spelling assessment that you can get from the Words Their Way, where we can also look at those phonological awareness pieces as well as the phonics pieces of how they take the sound from their brain to write the letter down on paper. And then a running record where we're looking at what students are using and confusing as well. Those are all great examples of diagnostic assessment data. But if we want to look at trends across a grade level, then we would want to see, what are the majority of our kindergartners doing, or what are the majority of our first or first grade students doing? What are the majority of our high school students doing? For that, we would want to have our grade level subject area teachers. We want to have everybody there who's got an invested stake in this. The social worker, again, if it is related to behavior. And then we want to set goals for the future. We want to figure out what additional data needs to be tested or collected. So that might look something like this. So 88% of our students were able to read 80% or more real CVC words at the end of first grade, and 85% or 60% or better on the nonsense words. But then when we look at, so in our district, this data isn't real for my district, but our goal is that students are proficient here by spring break of first grade. So we would recognize there's a real problem in first grade if this is happening at the end of the year and only 54% of students can read 80% or more real words with vowel teams. So we have these goals in mind, so we need to have conversations about what's happening in our classroom instruction to prepare students for this and to help them acquire the skills and knowledge that they need to be able to do to read that. And here's just another example, and this comes from the DRA. These are the different categories that are in the DRA. So we would recognize that our students are doing fairly well with prediction. They're at an independent level, 60% of them. But we're going to notice that nonfiction text features seems to be a problem across the grade level. So what is it that our classroom teachers are doing to help our second grade students with their nonfiction? How much nonfiction are they actually reading in class? Those are conversations that now we can start to have, because those assessments with some second graders are done one-on-one. Parts of them are done one-on-one with all students, and some are able to do them independently back at their seats, like reading the text and then coming back to answer the question. But we can gain a lot more information because we know what types of questions were asked. We have access to that. So what questions might you have about diagnostic data? All right, I'm really thorough, must be. Okay, so we'll now start talking about progress monitoring data. And oftentimes we think about this just for our students with special needs, but I think that's not the case. If you are sharing your diagnostic assessment data with your students and they are setting goals, we have kindergartners who truly want to be able to make 26 letter sounds for the 26 letters, and they can chart that progress, coloring in the different letters of the alphabet on a chart when they're able to access or when they're able to create the sounds that those letters make. Or we have high school students who recognize that they're only getting 40% on whatever kind of diagnostic assessment that you're giving in your class, and they have a goal that they want to get to 60%, and they can chart that growth. That's really, really powerful to help students see what kinds of things do I have control over that I can change those scores. So we want to know, are our students making progress? And that's really the only question that these are going to answer. One pitfall I want to talk about before I even start this slide that I've noticed that teachers are doing sometimes with this is, for example, if the broader skill is that we want our students to be able to read single-syllable words, regular single-syllable words, not the really tricky ones that the letters don't make the sounds that we expect that they make, then we have a sequence that we progress through. So in my district, it's CVC words, then R controlled, then CVCE, and then vowel teams. Well, our teachers might sometimes progress monitor to see whether or not students are getting closer to reading those one-syllable words by just giving CVC words. And then the next time, then maybe they'll just do the R controlled. But what we need to see if they're making progress is just a combination of all of those things. So we don't only want to assess just something very small that we're working on right now. We want to look at the bigger goal and see, are they making progress toward that bigger goal? Otherwise, when we look at our graphs of getting toward that target, it's going to look very funny. If that makes sense to you, they're going to go shoot up from their baseline where you're looking at all of those things to having a huge score when you're just assessing one of those small things. So just kind of keep that in mind. I've seen teachers trying to do that in the past. So these are frequent assessments of a specific skill. Again, I don't want you to forget about behavior, because that is, at least in my district, a problem we're facing a lot. We have a lot of behavior challenges, a lot of kids coming from trauma. So we want to really think about what kinds of things can we do to help students improve their behavior and be more independent social-emotional learners. So we have this frequent assessment of these skills, and that can be through AIMSWeb or using a maze, oral reading fluency or running record, letter naming fluency, that type of thing. And what we want to know is the intervention or instruction being effective? Is the student making gains? And if the student is not, it doesn't necessarily tell us why, it just tells us that it isn't. So we always want to be looking at an individual student in this case. If we were progress monitoring all of our students, that would probably be more of a diagnostic assessment, I would think. You probably don't have time to be progress monitoring every single one of your students in class unless you can teach them the skills of monitoring their own progress. If any of you use 6-minute fluency, where the students do, they read to a partner every day and then the partner helps them track how many words they were able to read in 1 minute, then they graph their hot reads and their cold reads, then the students are able to do something like that on their own, but they need to be taught. It's not just a skill that they come to us with. The student really should be part of this. They should really know. If you're a special education teacher and you're never sharing your progress monitoring data with the student so they have no idea whether or not they're making gains, it's not very meaningful for the student. It's just, oh, we're taking the test again today. So really inviting the student to be part of that conversation. And the next step is to analyze the instruction or intervention in terms of enablers and core features, which I'll talk about in just a second. Making instructional decisions, are you going to continue on with what you're doing because the student is making progress? Do we need to start something different? Do we need to just give it a little bit more time? Do we need to collect additional data? Does this goal even really match what it is that we want the student to know or be able to do? So here's an example. Excel will do this for you. There are also some things on interventioncentral.com that will help you to do this. But what we want to do is we want to start with where the student's baseline scores were. And sometimes we'll look at the first three kind of to get an average of where that student was before the intervention started. This dashed line right here means this is where we started our intervention. And then we have this goal. So in 12 weeks, the student is going to be able to do, it looks like about 42. Read 42 words correctly. And then we have this aim line. So in order for the student who was only able to read 7 words the first time we gave this assessment to be able to read 42 after 12 weeks, these are the gains that they have to make every week. So then we plot here in blue what it is that the student was actually able to do. And we want to see, do we have data points that are above or touching our aim line? Because when they're this far below the aim line for this long, it's a concern that maybe the intervention isn't working, but also might be a concern that we just haven't given it enough time yet. But we're really looking for our points to kind of be on or above that line. We want to usually see 3 data points in a row that are on or above that line to let us know that our intervention is being effective for that student. Do any of you have questions about this? Yeah.
You said it was Intervention
Central. Yep, I think by James Wright. John Wright? Somebody Wright. But they're really great. They have it all set up for you, but you can easily do this pretty easily in Excel as well. I know I set one of these up for my teacher so that they just had to put in the data points and the graph would happen for them as well. So what I talked about before is it truly that the intervention isn't working, or is it one of these core features that aren't in place? And so this is something that really takes a conversation with the individual teacher. They need to be reflective. They need to kind of be honest with themselves. So enablers make it possible. Like, if there's no time to do the intervention, it's not going to work. If there's no grouping, if you don't have an intervention that is meeting the student where he or she's at, it's not going to work. And if you don't have someone who's trained in the intervention, it's not going to work. But that in and of itself isn't enough. We need to make sure that we have precision, where the teacher who is instructing is focused on that key concept, that the intervention actually meets the need of the student, that it's focusing on that skill that we're trying to improve, that the student is actually engaging, that there are opportunities for the student to respond, that the teacher is not the only one doing the thinking and the talking. The student actually has to be using his or her brain and figuring some things out for him or herself. They have to be a participant in the learning. Then, is the student receiving feedback on where he or she is at? Are they looking at those graphs? Are they setting goals to make sure that they're getting closer to that goal that they have in mind at the end? And how much practice is that student actually engaging in? So I know that in our intervention groups that we have in my elementary school, the teachers have 15 minutes that they can be working with the kids. So they work with a group of kids for 15 minutes, then the kids transition 15 minutes to do independent reading, and then 15 minutes to do some writing. And during that practice time with the teacher, if the teacher is the only one doing the talking, the student didn't get any practice time. If the student really just needs to work on reading fluency, and you notice that they sharpen their pencil and go to the bathroom during those 15 minutes every day, they're not really getting any practice time. So those are some difficult conversations sometimes, and even with teachers' best intentions, sometimes those are the things that are failing the intervention from really helping the student make progress. Any questions about progress monitoring? All right. So next question, are my students learning the skills and knowledge I am intentionally teaching? So this is what I decided students are going to know and be able to do. Are they actually being able to do that? And for this, I think a really great data source is Common Assessment data. In my district, I'm going to just take a quick sidebar and talk about two things that have happened in my district that may be helpful to you or may just stimulate your thinking a little bit. Last year, I was in charge of running our school improvement team, where we had to write our school improvement plan and our district improvement plan. And I noticed that every year we have conversations around the SAT data and the MSTEP data. And every year, the teachers in those groups want to talk about what do we need to change in our classroom instruction to improve those scores. And we don't know the answer to that. That's not what those reports are designed for. That's not what those tests are designed for. Those tests are not designed for us to say which students can be in the advanced classes and which students need to be in the remedial classes. So I had an opportunity to get with teacher leaders, school board members, and all the administrators across the district. And I set up an assessment carousel. So I set out some progress monitoring data along with some graphs of a student, took off the student's name, over a period of time and let the teachers look at what the progress monitoring assessment looked like. Was it a maze? Was it an ORF? That type of thing. Classroom assessment, common assessment data, MSTEP data reports, diagnostic assessment data reports. And in small groups, they went around and answered questions of what do I know from this data and what questions do I still have after looking at this data. And it was a very powerful experience because when we came to the end, we recognized that our district improvement plan can't just be to get our MSTEP scores up because we don't know how, because we don't know what's lacking. But we did know exactly what was going on with our common assessment data. We knew exactly which types of questions our Algebra 2 kids couldn't answer. We knew exactly what questions our chemistry students were doing well with versus the ones they weren't doing well with. This was such a powerful tool for us that we weren't using. And that when our district wasn't requiring that every content area has common assessments, there's no opportunity for teachers to get together and say, oh my gosh, 80% of your students are doing quadratic equations correctly, and I have 32% of mine. How are you teaching that? What are you doing? What resources are you using? That wasn't happening before, because they weren't even necessarily giving the same test or on the same page. So we talked about how huge this was going to be. So this year, that was our new district improvement plan, and our new school improvement plans were that we were going to have 70% of students score 70% or better on our common assessment. But really, the goal behind that, because we're not necessarily meeting that goal just yet, the goal behind that was we needed to start having teacher conversations that we couldn't have before when two people weren't doing the same things. We couldn't see across a grade level what knowledge and skills students were and were not acquiring. So it has been super impactful. So I just wanted to kind of share that with you and getting our school board members on board with that and our administrators who sometimes forget that. Sometimes we have to remind them. But it was just really nice to have everyone on the same page with that common goal. So a common assessment is a locally created or agreed upon assessment that all teachers in the same grade and content area will give to their students and score in a common way. And we started off with math this year, just very recently got into the writing. We have a platform that we're using to record that data. We wanted it to look as MSTEP-like as possible, so we're using an online test engine that scores everything except the essays. But we got together. I was working with a group of first grade teachers, and they were doing a common writing piece, and they wanted the students to capitalize the sentences. And one teacher was adamant, they're either getting a 1 or a 0. Either they had correct capitalization across the board or they had 0. And one teacher said, I'm not comfortable with that. Like, what if they capitalize most of the right words, but they don't capitalize all of them? And the team was like, nope, all or nothing. So then we came back together to look at our data, and we were able to see that in one classroom, 88% of the students capitalized correctly, got that 1. And in most of the other classrooms, it was closer to about 40%. And I said to the teacher that I got 40%. I was like, what do you think was going on here? And she said, they capitalized most of them, but we said all or nothing. So I couldn't give it to them. There were only about 40% of the kids that truly every time there needed to be something capitalized, it was. And so I said to the teacher who got 88, my goodness, how are you doing that? And she's like, oh, I thought it was close enough. So we then had this conversation that we can't even analyze this data together because the data is not very accurate. So on their own came to the conclusion that I knew before this happened that they needed to come together to score it. So at the next PLC, we weren't looking at data. They were bringing their sample assessments together, and they were going to score them together and then decide, is 4 out of 5 sentences enough? Are we going to give that a 1? But now everyone's on the same page. So now we really can say, hey, what are you doing that's really helping your students understand they need to capitalize? One teacher was talking about how when she asks her students to do a conclusion in second grade, it's basically copying the topic sentence, just using a transition word at the beginning of it. So maybe in conclusion, or that's why I think that, and she has them draw an arrow to it. So they circle the topic sentence and they draw an arrow to it. None of the other teachers on the team were doing that, and she had 86% of her kids getting the score for conclusion, and the other teachers had about 40. And they're like, I could show my kids how to do that. What a great idea. So now the conversations are much deeper. We're seeing how things are going across the board with all of our students, getting our teachers to be leaders, getting them to share their ideas and things that are going on in their classroom. So some examples of this are end of unit assessments, end of quarter assessments, or skill assessments. We can look at the individual student and how well they did, but we can also look at the groups of students. And we can talk about the disconnects between teaching and learning. This is what I really thought the focus was, and the students didn't do well on it, or well, I didn't care that much about that. Here was the big focus, and this is what the students did well on. Those are the kinds of conversations we're going to have now. So as you can tell, I put a lot of value into this type of assessment because it's what the teacher said. This is what I'm going to make sure they can do, and now we're going to see whether or not they can. But we don't know, will the skills or knowledge transfer beyond the assessment, which especially when our teachers are doing vocabulary assessments is the majority of their test. So sometimes they need a little help in creating their assessments to be transfer of knowledge assessments. And we don't know what in the moment needs to change because that comes with our formative assessment process, which I'll talk about in just a second. So I found that it can be really helpful to analyze our common assessments if we have them organized so that types of skills are together on the test, so that we can look at questions 1 through 4 that are kind of assessing that same skill or knowledge set, and we can see how did kids do on that chunk of questions. Whereas if it's question 1 and 17 and you're not using an electronic program that can group those back together for you, that can be a real big challenge. When we have to analyze during our 40-minute PLC, we don't have time to analyze every single question, but can we look at trends that are happening? That common scoring, a big piece that I was really happy that every teacher group that I met with recognize that after the first time, recognizing that they couldn't compare their scores very well. We have to determine rigor. So that means that, again, they're getting together to say, what are we accepting on this essay type answer? And then having those exemplars, which has been a big focus in our district this year of talking about what is that success criteria and what are we expecting from students. So ideally, we're going to have a skill or question level breakdown of the class and the grade. We might also look at subgroups. In my district, we don't have a lot of subgroups. But in some districts, you have your English language learners. You might just have boys versus girls. So we don't have a lot of that in my district, but we do have a lot of looking at individual students' data and then the classes and then the grade level as a whole. So we want to have our classroom teachers there, our special education teachers there, especially if they're the ones who are helping to accommodate the test. And the next step would be to collect information from the students. This is something that the teachers sometimes are struggling with. I went in to observe a classroom where they were going over their common assessment data, and for 30 minutes, the teacher told the kids why they got the things wrong that they got wrong. Like, most of you picked B because it said this, but really the answer was C because of this. But she didn't hear one time from a student why that student picked B, or what strategy that student who did pick C used to know that question, to get that question correct. So we're having a lot of conversations about how the mistakes on these types of assessments, because we think we taught all this, we think they should know this, but we can talk about those mistakes that are a great opportunity for learning from students and for students to learn from one another. So sometimes that has been a bit of a challenge, but that's really been a powerful thing for us this year in my district. So here's an example. If we wanted to know whether or not students can create models of fractions, we had 90% of students on mastery at that, and 0% were emerging, so every student had some skill level at creating models of fractions. But then when we get down to this, I can solve real world problems involving equivalent fractions, That's a problem. So now we can start talking about, was there a specific teacher who did this better than the others? Or do we see that we thought we taught this, but when we really take a look back at what types of tools did we use to teach this, what types of strategies were we showing students, what kind of problem-solving opportunities were students able to discourse around, were they really there? Something that we wouldn't have known before. And then here is an example of, if any of you use Illuminate, this just came from Illuminate, we can click on this question 21 to see what it was. But this is where we can look at, this is actually a bad example, this one right here, 52% or 52 of the students picked question or answer B, but 36% picked A. Let's take a look at distractor A and see what made it such a strong distractor. And then an even better conversation is to have that with students and say to students, what made you pick A? If you picked A here, what was drawing you to A? And do you recognize why B was the correct answer? Go ahead and talk with your group, and I'm going to come around and listen to what you're saying. Or maybe we'll have a whole group conversation about that. Very, very powerful information from students there. Any questions around common assessment data? I think it can be very powerful for your teachers. They don't have control over MSTEP. They don't have control over what's on that benchmark screeners. They don't usually have control over their progress monitoring screeners because those are usually created by either Intervention Central, they have free ones, or you're using something like AIMSWeb or Dibbles.
Do you have your teachers always align their test questions on the common assessment to a standard?
Yeah, or else we keep it... Yes, or we keep it really very small, so we're looking at a skill, because we don't have a ton of time. So knowing that we're only going to have 45 minutes, it might be that the students are going to take an assessment over two skills, so we can get together just to talk about those two skills. And something else that we've given the teachers the flexibility to do, because these common assessments are intended to be more challenging, we want them to be the students having to use the knowledge, not just regurgitation of the knowledge, that the teachers don't have to use them for a grade at all if they don't want to, because the purpose is for us to have conversations as adults about what's going well and to talk to the students about the problem-solving skills that they have. So teachers have complete flexibility.
They can choose to grade it or not grade it.
Correct. The computer system that we're using right now, we use Edgelastic, it scores it, but the teachers can choose whether or not to grade it. No, I haven't had any yet, because it sounds like when the teachers are doing the conversation the day after, the kids are really engaging in that. So they're liking to share their thinking, their strategies, what they didn't notice in the question that made them get it wrong. The teachers are really liking the questions that there's more than one correct answer, because they're finding that on MSTEP and stuff, the kids don't pick three answers or don't pick two answers, and now we can have those conversations with students that it's not against the law to be having, or we didn't actually know what the question was. All right, and then if our question is just, is our Tier 1 instruction aligned with the expectation of the Michigan State Standards, then that's when we can use MSTEP or PSAT. If your question is at an individual student level or at a classroom level, this is not going to help you. But if you are just wondering, in general, across our district, is, or even across our building, is our Tier 1 instruction aligned with the Michigan standards, Common Core State Standards? So it will determine final success or failure after instruction has ended. There's no more instruction going on. Your kids don't even get the reports until the next school year, if you even share it with them then, because it's so old. This is your MSTEP, your MyAccess, your AP exams, your SAT, a final exam in a class, because that's usually on the last day of school and they're not coming back tomorrow, or a performance task when they get on stage in front of an audience. There's no do-over. No chance to take that back and rewind. So the questions that we'll answer is our Tier 1 curriculum and instruction effective and aligned? But it won't tell us about individual student needs. It won't tell us about what knowledge or skills they're lacking. So ideally, we're looking at a whole grade level, either from the building or from the district, getting that grade level team together to talk about that data. Special education teachers can be helpful there. Our district grade band curriculum supervisor. And then our next step is to say, do we have evidence from our local level of what students are doing well and need to work on within those targets and claims that are being reported on the MSTEP? Because if we just know that our MSTEP scores aren't good, we oftentimes don't know why they're not good. And that's where the common assessment data and sometimes our diagnostic assessment data can help us. Any questions about that? This is the one I see getting used incorrectly most often. an administrator say to me the other day, like I said at the beginning, we use Beacon as our universal screener. It runs just like MSTEP. The teachers aren't allowed to look at the questions. The kid gets their score at the end of, you know, it takes 2 hours to do the ELA, 1 hour to do the math. It's computer adaptive, so it's really just an MSTEP experience. And she wanted the teachers to talk to the kids about what skills they need to work on to improve. And I was like, they can't. They don't know what skills they need to work on, just like the MSTEP. If you want them to know what skills they need to work on, then let's pull out those common assessments and see what skills the students aren't performing well on. So sometimes we have to remind, but that is the purpose. And then my favorite, so what do my individual and groups of students need right now during the learning process? And this is where the formative assessment evidence comes in. So this is a graph that was put out by the FAME Project. I just wanted to check time, I apologize. This is how much information we're gonna get about an individual student from our national assessment. Our state assessment, we get a little bit more, and I think the only reason this is a little bit higher is because we do get those individual student reports that tells us whether or not they were proficient, but doesn't tell us whether or not their dog passed away the night before, they couldn't stay awake during the test, the internet kept going out, they didn't care because it wasn't for a grade. Then we have our district assessments, which is our common assessments, where we find out a little bit more, and then our classroom assessments. And I don't necessarily like that word of classroom assessments, because a lot of times that's going to be a dialogue, a conversation, turn and share with your partner, solve this on your whiteboard and hold it up so that I can see it. It's observation. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about classroom assessments. It's really just any evidence you can collect about student learning. But it's not that quiz at the end of the week or that quiz at the end of the hour, because formative assessments aren't a thing, it's a process. So here we have a picture of the formative assessment project from the FAME project. And the big ideas of the formative assessment process is that the teacher has a predetermined plan for what the student will learn. Everything is planned out. You know what you want students to know and be able to do, unlike that teacher I was talking about at the beginning who said she'd know it when she saw it. It's intentional and focused instruction and practice based on the goals and outcomes that are clear to the teachers and to the students, because students can't hit a target that they can't see and don't know what it is or what it means. When we can engage students in that process of creating those targets together in student-friendly language, that's even more powerful. It's in the moment checks for understanding. Dylan Willem, I think, says this best when he says, if your students have left the classroom and you don't know where they are, you're behind the eight ball. You almost can't catch up from that. If you come back tomorrow and still don't know where they are when class begins, you're not going to catch up from that. We have to know right now where our students are at. Margaret Heritage says, if students give you some sort of information through dialogue or through writing something on paper, sharing with a partner, and you don't do something with it to make it obsolete in the next 30 seconds, then you haven't done your job. So whatever I know about you as a learner right now, I need to do something with, so that 30 seconds from now, I know something different about you as a learner. And 30 seconds might not be accurate. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer for a task, but just that idea that we don't want our students to be where they are tomorrow, where they're at today. It's instantaneous feedback that moves students forward, so it's not waiting 2 weeks to score a paper. I was at a meeting with some teachers and I said, we need to be talking about what students know and are able to do. We need to give them feedback in the moment. And she said, I still have 2-week-old essays on my desk that I haven't been able to get back to them yet. And I was like, you might as well recycle them, because I hope your students know more now than they knew 2 weeks ago. Now, it's different if that was a summative assessment. Like, that's going to be your grade. We've finished with that. We've moved on. That's the end of it. Well, then maybe you could take 2 weeks, because you don't expect them to use the feedback anyway. That purpose is for a grade, not for feedback. But we can't give our students feedback 2 weeks later, because if they've learned nothing in 2 weeks, what have we been doing in our classrooms? And then making those instructional decisions. So it just kind of works in this process. Students always at the center. The teacher's done the planning. The students and the teachers are involved in creating these learning targets. What's it going to look like? The teacher constantly eliciting evidence of student learning, doing something with that, providing feedback to students based on where they're at right now and the next steps to get closer to that goal. And then the teacher making those decisions about what are we going to do? What am I going to do with Johnny? And what am I going to do with the whole class? So formative assessment is a planned, ongoing process used by all students and teachers during learning and teaching to elicit and use evidence of student learning to improve student understanding of intended, that pre-planned, disciplinary learning outcomes and support students to become more self-directed learners. So the idea is that students will take ownership over their own learning. Classroom discussions are my favorite because there's nothing to grade, nothing to take away from that. I know right where my students are at. I have to plan some questions, some things I want students to know and be able to do. I have to plan the things I want them to be talking about, but I'm not taking anything home to grade so that tomorrow I can plan how I'm going to get Johnny from A little bit closer to B. Work samples are also really great, but again, don't mistake this for a quiz or a ticket out the door. Questions the data is intended to answer is about individual students and how they're doing, and groups of students and how they're moving toward that desired goal. It does not answer what grade I should give students. You know, if our parents gave up on us the first time they hoped we would walk because we didn't, and they're like, well, I guess you're not going to be able to walk, none of us would be walking. So we can't penalize kids during the learning process. If they already knew it, they wouldn't be coming to us. We would have no job to do if they already knew it. And sometimes it can be easy to pat ourselves on the back when that kid's constantly raising their hand and getting it and like, I helped with that. Like, now that kid gets it, but maybe that kid already had it before they came into class. We're talking about, do all of our students get it? Are they moving forward at least? So we want to be looking at individual students and groups and subgroups of students. We want the student to be really involved with this. It means nothing if the student doesn't take some ownership in this. If the student can't recognize where they're at on their learning trajectory, a big focus in my district this year has been to create success criteria and created a protocol to get students engaged in that. So I have the opportunity, we had to entice teachers with PD hours, but and make it mandatory, PD hours. But they come twice a month to meet with me, and on the first meeting of the month, I show them some exemplars for a target that all teachers should be doing. All of our teachers should be asking students to share their opinion. So the first Monday of the month, we come together and we look at exemplars of opinion papers. Teachers take time in groups pulling out what makes that an exemplar. What is the success criteria for a really good opinion paper? Can we come to some consensus across the building about what we want all of our students to do with opinion papers? And then they take those exemplars back to their students, or they have their students just write an opinion paper. And then they look at really good examples and not so great examples and have students analyze them. And now the students are the ones who are saying, this is what makes this paper great, and this is the goal that we have for ourselves. They're developing that success criteria. Now the teachers have already done it, so if the students are leaving something out, they can facilitate their thinking through asking questions. If the students are way off track and say, oh, a good opinion paper has 5 paragraphs, well, not always. So we can kind of talk about how this is a really good opinion paper and it's much shorter than 5, or this is a good one and it's much longer. Now the students have some ownership. They truly understand that. It's in their words. So now when they look at their own papers, they can see, where am I at compared to that really good paper? Where am I at with that success criteria? The teachers are talking about how the feedback students are giving to one another are based now on those targets, those success criteria. Now we're having conversations like, your topic sentence doesn't really fit with the evidence that you're trying to use to support it, with your reasons and evidence, as compared to, it looks okay, I'd give it a B. That's not the purpose of student feedback. That's not the purpose of self-feedback. We're not asking students to grade themselves. We're asking students to say, what are you doing well based on that list of success criteria you helped to develop and understand because you had part in that, and what are you going to do to get better? We have our kindergartners now who are scoring their writing based on these different levels of, here's where we've got scribbles, and here's where we have complete sentences, and where are you at on these 9 continuum pieces in between, and what's your goal to get to that next one? Because what makes that next one a little bit better than the one before it? That's really powerful when our kindergartners are able to do things like that, and especially when our high schoolers can do things like that. So, in summary, before that, does anyone have any questions about this? I'm going a little fast, but I know somebody wants to get on the road. In summary, this is something that tripped me up for a really long time. Balanced assessment doesn't mean equal assessment. So, the state assessment can't mean as much to us if we're individual classroom teachers as our formative assessment data, our formative assessment evidence. So keep that in mind. Like, these are the pie pieces. Like, if we want to know about individual students in individual classrooms, this is our formative assessment, this is our common assessment, and this is kind of the rest of it. So just keep that in mind. It doesn't mean equal. Data analysis has to be safe. Teachers, I had a group of teachers who said, please don't put my name up there when you show the classroom scores. And it took the superintendent, it was only one grade level. All the rest of them were like, yeah, I want to know who did that well, and I want to hear from that person, and I would like them to help me. the superintendent had to come in and say, we can't have the conversations we need to have. This has nothing to do with our teacher evaluation. Again, the teachers don't have to put it on the report card or even in their gradebook for the students, but we can't have those conversations if it's not a safe space where teachers want to learn from one another. And what this will result in is that increased student learning. So that is the end. If you have any questions, you can stick around, but I know that probably you want to get going. But does anyone have any questions? All right, if you, the PowerPoint is available on the website, but I also put the tiny URL link up here at the very beginning of the presentation. And at the end of this presentation is actually a protocol to use to go through data. So if anybody does have questions about what protocol we use, you're welcome to stay. I know that there's going to be terrible traffic leaving, and I don't know how far you all have to go. So thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.